Who would go on at that point? Wouldn't every sensible person quit, drop out, refuse the experimenter's demands to go on shocking him? Here is what one teacher reported about his reaction. "I didn't know what the hell was going on. I think, you know, maybe I'm killing this guy. I told the experimenter that I was not taking responsibility for going further. That's it." But when the experimenter reassured him that he would take the responsibility, the worried teacher obeyed and continued to the very end. And almost everyone who got that far did the same as this man. How is that possible? If they got that far, why did they continue on to the bitter end? One reason for this startling level of obedience may be related to the teacher's not knowing how to exit from the situation, rather than just blind obedience. Most participants dissented from time to time, saying they did not want to go on, but the experimenter did not let them out, continually coming up with reasons why they had to stay, and prodding them to continue testing their suffering learner. Usually protests work and you can get out of unpleasant situations, but nothing you say affects this impervious experimenter who insists that you must stay and continue to shock errors. You look at the shock panel and realize that the easiest exit lies at the end of the last shock lever. A few more lever presses is the fast way out, with no hassles from the experimenter and no further moans from the now silent learner. Voila! 450 volts is the easy way out, achieving your freedom without directly confronting the authority figure or having to reconcile the suffering you have already caused with this additional pain to the victim. It is a simple matter of up and then out. Variations on an obedience theme. Over the course of a year, Milgram carried out 19 different experiments. Each one a different variation of the basic paradigm of experimenter, teacher, learner, memory testing, errors shocked. In each of these studies, he varied one social psychological variable and observed its impact on the extent of obedience to the unjust authority's pressure to continue to shock the learner victim. In one study, he added women. In others, he varied the physical proximity or remoteness of either the experimenter-teacher link or the teacher-learner link, had peers rebel or obey before the teacher had the chance to begin, and more. In one set of experiments, Milgram wanted to show that his results were not due to the authority power of Yale University, which is what New Haven is all about. So he transplanted his laboratory to a run-down office building in downtown Bridgeport, Connecticut, and repeated the experiment as a project, ostensibly of a private research firm with no apparent connection to Yale. It made no difference. The participants fell under the same spell of this situational power. The data clearly revealed the extreme pliability of human nature. Almost everyone could be totally obedient, or almost everyone could resist authority pressures. It all depended on the situational variables they experienced. Milgram was able to demonstrate that compliance rates could soar to over 90% of people continuing the 450-volt maximum, or be reduced to less than 10%, by introducing just one crucial variable into the compliance recipe. Want maximum obedience? Make the subject a member of a teaching team in which the job of pulling the shock lever to punish the victim is given to another person, a confederate, while the subject assists with other parts of the procedure. Want people to resist authority pressures? Provide social models of peers who rebelled. Participants also refused to deliver the shocks if the learner said he wanted to be shocked. That's masochistic, and they are not sadists. They were also reluctant to give high levels of shock when the experimenter filled in as the learner. They were more likely to shock when the learner was remote than in proximity. In each of the other variations on this diverse range of ordinary American citizens, of widely varying ages and occupations and of both genders, it was possible to elicit low, medium, or high levels of compliant obedience with a flick of the situational switch. as if one were simply turning a human nature dial within their psyches. This large sample of 1,000 ordinary citizens from such varied backgrounds makes the results of the Milgram obedience studies among the most generalizable in all the social sciences. When you think of the long and gloomy history of man, you will find far more hideous crimes have been committed in the name of obedience than have been committed in the name of rebellion. C.P. Snow, Either Or, 1961. 10 Lessons from the Milgram Studies, Creating Evil Traps for Good People. Let's outline some of the procedures in this research paradigm that seduced many ordinary citizens to engage in this apparently harmful behavior. In doing so, I want to draw parallels to compliance strategies used by influence professionals in real-world settings, such as salespeople, cult and military recruiters, media advertisers, and others. There are 10 methods we can extract from Milgram's paradigm for this purpose. 1. Prearranging some form of contractual obligation, verbal or written, to control the individual's behavior in pseudo-legal fashion. In Milgram's experiment, this was done by publicly agreeing to accept the tasks and the procedures. 2. Giving participants meaningful roles to play, teacher, learner, that carry with them previously learned positive values and automatically activate response scripts. 3. Presenting basic rules to be followed that seem to make sense before their actual use, but can then be used arbitrarily and impersonally to justify mindless compliance. Also, systems control people by making their rules vague and changing them as necessary, but insisting that rules are rules and thus must be followed, as the researcher in the lab coat did in Milgram's experiment, or the SPE guards did to force prisoner Clay, 416, to eat the sausages. 4. Altering the semantics of the act, the actor, and the action, from hurting victims to helping the experimenter, punishing the former for the lofty goal of scientific discovery. Replacing unpleasant reality with desirable rhetoric, gilding the frame so that the real picture is disguised. We can see the same semantic framing at work in advertising, where, for example, bad-tasting mouthwash is framed as good for you because it kills germs and tastes like medicine is expected to taste. 5. Creating opportunities for the diffusion of responsibility or abdication of responsibility for negative outcomes. Others will be responsible, or the actor won't be held liable. In Milgram's experiment, the authority figure said, when questioned by any teacher, that he would take responsibility for anything that happened to the learner. 6. Starting the path toward the ultimate evil act with a small, seemingly insignificant first step, the easy foot in the door that swings open subsequent greater compliance pressures and leads down a slippery slope. In the obedience study, the initial shock was only a mild 15 volts. This is also the operative principle in turning good kids into drug addicts with that first little hit or sniff. 7. Having successively increasing steps on the pathway that are gradual so that they are hardly noticeably different from one's most recent prior action. Just a little bit more. By increasing each level of aggression in gradual steps of only 15-volt increments over the 30 switches, no new level of harm seemed like a noticeable difference from the prior level to Milgram's participants. 8. Gradually changing the nature of the authority figure, the researcher in Milgram's study, from initially just and reasonable to unjust and demanding, even irrational. This tactic elicits initial compliance and later confusion, since we expect consistency from authorities and friends. Not acknowledging that this transformation has occurred leads to mindless obedience. And it is part of many date rape scenarios and a reason why abused women stay with their abusing spouses. 9. Making the exit costs high and making the process of exiting difficult by allowing verbal dissent, which makes people feel better about themselves, while insisting on behavioral compliance. 10. Offering an ideology or a big lie to justify the use of any means to achieve the seemingly desirable essential goal. In Milgram's research, this came in the form of providing an acceptable justification or rationale for engaging in the undesirable action, such as that science wants to help people improve their memory by judicious use of reward and punishment. In social psychology experiments, this tactic is known as the cover story because it is a cover-up for the procedures that follow, which might be challenged because they do not make sense on their own. The real-world equivalent is known as an ideology. Most nations rely on an ideology, typically threats to national security, before going to war or to suppress dissident political opposition. When citizens fear that their national security is being threatened, they become willing to surrender their basic freedoms to a government that offers them that exchange. Eric Fromm's classic analysis in Escape from Freedom made us aware of this trade-off, which Hitler and other dictators have long used to gain and maintain power, namely, the claim that they will be able to provide security in exchange for citizens giving up their freedoms, which will give them the ability to control things better. Such procedures are utilized in varied influence situations where those in authority want others to do their bidding, but know that few would engage in the end game without first being properly prepared psychologically to do the unthinkable. In the future, when you are in a compromising position where your compliance is at stake, thinking back to these stepping stones to mindless obedience may enable you to step back and not go all the way down the path, their path. A good way to avoid crimes of obedience is to assert one's personal authority and always take full responsibility for one's actions. Replications and extensions of the Milgram obedience model. Because of its structural design and its detailed protocol, the basic Milgram obedience experiment encouraged replication by independent investigators in many countries. A recent comparative analysis was made of the rates of obedience in 8 studies conducted in the United States and 9 replications in European, African, and Asian countries. There were comparably high levels of compliance by research volunteers in these different studies and nations. The majority obedience effect of a mean 61% found in the U.S. replications was matched by the 66% obedience rate found across all the other national samples. The range of obedience went from a low of 31% to a high of 91% in the U.S. studies, and from a low of 28%, Australia, to a high of 88%, South Africa, in the cross-national replications. There was also stability of obedience over decades of time as well as over place. There was no association between when a study was done, between 1963 and 1985, and degree of obedience. Obedience to a powerful, legitimate authority. In the original obedience studies, the subjects conferred authority status on the person conducting the experiment because he was in an institutional setting and was dressed and acted like a serious scientist, even though he was only a high school biology teacher paid to play that role. His power came from being perceived as a representative of an authority system. In Milgram's Bridgeport replication described earlier, the absence of the prestigious institutional setting of Yale reduced the obedience rate to 47.5%, compared to 65% at Yale, although this drop was not a statistically significant one. Several later studies showed how powerful the obedience effect can be when legitimate authorities exercise their power within their power domains. When a college professor was the authority figure telling college student volunteers that their task was to train a puppy by conditioning its behavior using electric shocks, he elicited 75% obedience from them. In this experiment, both the experimenter, teacher, and the learner were authentic. That is, college students acted as the teacher, attempting to condition a cuddly little puppy, the learner, in an electrified apparatus. The puppy was supposed to learn a task, and shocks were given when it failed to respond correctly in a given time interval. As in Milgram's experiments, they had to deliver a series of 30 graded shocks, up to 450 volts in the training process. Each of the 13 male and 13 female subjects individually saw and heard the puppy squealing and jumping around the electrified grid as they pressed lever after lever. There was no doubt that they were hurting the puppy with each shock they administered. Although the shock intensities were much lower than indicated by the voltage labels appearing on the shock box, they were still powerful enough to evoke clearly distressed reactions from the puppy with each successive press of the shock switches. As you might imagine, the students were clearly upset during the experiment. Some of the females cried, and the male students also expressed a lot of distress. Did they refuse to continue once they could see the suffering they were causing right before their eyes? For all too many, their personal distress did not lead to behavioral disobedience. About half of the males, 54%, went all the way to 450 volts. The big surprise came from the women's high level of obedience. Despite their dissent and weeping, 100% of the female college students obeyed to the full extent possible in shocking the puppy as it tried to solve an insoluble task. A similar result was found in an unpublished study with adolescent high school girls. The typical finding with human victims, including Milgram's own findings, is that there are no male-female gender differences in obedience. Some critics of the obedience experiments tried to invalidate Milgram's findings by arguing that subjects quickly discover that the shocks are fake, and that is why they continue to give them to the very end. This study, conducted back in 1972 by psychologists Charles Sheridan and Richard King, removes any doubt that Milgram's high obedience rates could have resulted from subjects' disbelief that they were actually hurting the learner victim. Sheridan and King showed that there was an obvious visual connection between a subject's obedience reactions and a puppy's pain. Of further interest is the finding that half of the males who disobeyed lied to their teacher in reporting that the puppy had learned the insoluble task, a deceptive form of disobedience. When students in a comparable college class were asked to predict how far an average woman would go on this task, they estimated 0%, a far cry from 100%. However, this faulty low estimate is reminiscent of the 1% figure given by the psychiatrists who assessed the Milgram paradigm. Again, this underscores one of my central arguments, that it is difficult for people to appreciate fully the power of situational forces acting on individual behavior when they are viewed outside the behavioral context. Physicians' power over nurses to mistreat patients. If the relationship between teachers and students is one of power-based authority, how much more so is that between physicians and nurses? How difficult is it then for a nurse to disobey an order from the powerful authority of the doctor when she knows it is wrong? To find out, a team of doctors and nurses tested obedience in their authority system by determining whether nurses would follow or disobey an illegitimate request by an unknown physician in a real hospital setting. Each of 22 nurses individually received a call from a staff doctor whom she had never met. He told her to administer a medication to a patient immediately so that it would take effect by the time he arrived at the hospital. He would sign the drug order then. He ordered her to give his patient 20 milligrams of the drug Astrogen. The label on the container of estrogen indicated that 5 milliliters was usual and warned that 10 milliliters was the maximum dose. His order doubled that high dose. The conflict created in the minds of each of these caregivers was whether to follow this order from an unfamiliar phone caller to administer an excessive dose of medicine, or follow standard medical practice, which rejects such unauthorized orders. When this dilemma was presented as a hypothetical scenario to a dozen nurses in that hospital, 10 said they would refuse to obey. However, when other nurses were put on the hot seat where they were faced with the physician's imminent arrival and possible anger at being disobeyed, the nurses almost unanimously caved in and complied. All but one of 22 nurses put to the real test started to pour the medication, actually a placebo, to administer to the patient, before the researchers stopped them from doing so. That solitary, disobedient nurse should have been given a raise and a hero's medal. This dramatic effect is far from isolated. Equally high levels of blind obedience to doctors' almighty authority showed up in a recent survey of a large sample of registered nurses. Nearly half, 46% of the nurses reported that they could recall a time when they had, in fact, carried out a physician's order that you felt could have had harmful consequences to the patient. These compliant nurses attributed less responsibility to themselves than they did to the physician when they followed an inappropriate command. In addition, they indicated that the primary basis of social power of physicians is their legitimate power, the right to provide overall care to the patient. They were just following what they construed as legitimate orders. But then the patient died. Thousands of hospitalized patients die needlessly each year due to a variety of staff mistakes, some of which, I assume, include such unquestioning obedience of nurses and tech aides to physicians' wrong orders. Deadly obedience to authority. This potential for authority figures to exercise power over subordinates can have disastrous consequences in many domains of life. One such example is found in the dynamics of obedience in commercial airline cockpits, which have been shown to lead to many airline accidents. In a typical commercial airline cockpit, the captain is the central authority over a first officer and sometimes a flight engineer, and the might of that authority is enforced by organizational norms, the military background of most pilots, and flight rules that make the pilot directly responsible for operating the aircraft. Such authority can lead to flight errors when the crew feels forced to accept the authority's definition of the situation, even when the authority is wrong. An investigation of 37 serious plane accidents where there were sufficient data from voice recorders revealed that in 81% of these cases, the first officer did not properly monitor or challenge the captain when he had made errors. Using a larger sample of 75 plane accidents as the context for evaluating destructive obedience, the author of this study concludes, "If we assume that both monitoring and challenging errors are due to excessive obedience, we may conclude that excessive obedience may cause as many as 25% of all airplane accidents." Administrative obedience to authority. In modern society, people in positions of authority rarely punish others with physical violence, as in the Milgram paradigm. What is more typical is mediated violence, where authorities pass along orders to underlings who carry them out, or the violence involves verbal abuse that undercuts the self-esteem and dignity of the powerless. Authorities often take actions that are punitive and whose consequences are not directly observable. For example, giving hostile feedback to someone that knowingly will disrupt their performance and adversely affect their chances of getting a job qualifies as a form of such socially mediated violence. A team of Dutch researchers assessed the extension of authority-based obedience to such a situation in a series of ingenious experiments involving 25 separate studies of nearly 500 participants, from 1982 to 1985 at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. In their administrative obedience paradigm, the experimenter told the research participant, acting as administrator, to make a series of 15 stress remarks to a job applicant, a trained accomplice, in the next room. Specifically, the subjects were instructed to administer a job selection test to the applicant. If he passed the test, he would get the job. If he failed, he would remain unemployed. They were also instructed to disturb and stress the applicant while giving him the test. These 15 graded remarks were critical of his test performance and also denigrated his personality, such as, "That was really stupid of you." As the participant administrators delivered these ever more hostile remarks, they placed the applicant under such intense psychological strain that he did not perform satisfactorily and, consequently, failed to get the job. In addition, they were told by the researchers to continue despite any protests from the applicant. Any dissent by the participant administrators was countered with up to 4 prods by the experimenter to continue the hostile remarks before they were finally permitted to stop if they were adamant. Finally, and most significantly, the subjects were informed that the ability to work under stress was not an essential job requirement, but the procedure had to be followed because it assisted the experimenter's research project, which was studying how stress affects test performance. Causing distress and hurting another person's job chances had no further use than the researcher's collection of some data. In the control condition, subjects could stop making the stress remarks at any point they chose. When asked to predict whether they would make all the stress remarks under these circumstances, more than 90% of a separate set of comparable Dutch respondents said they would not comply. Again, the outsider's view was way off base. Fully 91% of the subjects obeyed the authoritative experiment to the very end of the line. This same degree of extreme obedience held up even when personnel officers were used as the subjects, despite their professional code of ethics for dealing with clients. Similarly, high obedience was found when subjects were sent advance information several weeks before their appearance at the laboratory, so that they had time to reflect on the nature of their potentially hostile role. How might we generate disobedience in this setting? You can choose among several options. Have several peers rebel before the subject's turn, as in Milgram's study. Or notify the subject of his or her legal liability if the applicant victim were harmed and sued the university. Or eliminate the authority pressure to go all the way, as in the control condition of this research, where no one fully obeyed. Sexual obedience to authority. The strip search scam. Strip search scams have been perpetrated in a number of fast food restaurant chains throughout the United States. This phenomenon demonstrates the pervasiveness of obedience to an anonymous but seemingly important authority. The modus operandi is for an assistant store manager to be called to the phone by a male caller who identifies himself as a police officer named, say, Scott. He needs their urgent help with a case of employee theft at that restaurant. He insists on being called Sir in their conversation. Earlier, he has gotten relevant inside information about store procedures and local details. He also knows how to solicit the information he wants through skillfully guided questions, as stage magicians and mind readers do. He is a good con man. Ultimately, Officer Scott solicits from the assistant manager the name of the attractive young new employee who, he says, has been stealing from the shop and is believed to have contraband on her now. He wants her to be isolated in the rear room and held until he or his men can pick her up. The employee is detained there and is given the option by the Sir officer who talks to her on the phone of either being strip-searched then and there by a fellow employee or brought down to headquarters to be strip-searched there by the police. Invariably, she elects to be searched now, since she knows she is innocent and has nothing to hide. The caller then instructs the assistant manager to strip-search her. Her anus and vagina are searched for stolen money or drugs. All the while, the caller insists on being told in graphic detail what is happening, And all the while, the video surveillance cameras are recording these remarkable events as they unfold. But this is only the beginning of a nightmare for the innocent young employee and a sexual and power turn-on for the caller voyeur. In a case in which I was an expert witness, this basic scenario then included having the frightened 18-year-old high school senior engage in a series of increasingly embarrassing and sexually degrading activities. The naked woman is told to jump up and down and to dance around. The assistant manager is told by the caller to get some older male employee to help confine the victim so she can go back to her duties in the restaurant. The scene degenerates into the caller insisting that the woman masturbate herself and have oral sex with the older male, who is supposedly containing her in the back room while the police are slowly wending their way to the restaurant. These sexual activities continue for several hours while they wait for the police to arrive, which, of course, never happens. This bizarre authority influence in absentia seduces many people in that situation to violate store policy, and presumably their own ethical and moral principles, to sexually molest and humiliate an honest, church-going young employee. In the end, the store personnel are fired, some are charged with crimes, the store is sued, the victims are seriously distressed, and the perpetrator in this and similar hoaxes, a former corrections officer, is finally caught, but surprisingly was acquitted by a Kentucky jury. One reasonable reaction to learning about this hoax is to focus on the dispositions of the victim and her assailants as naive, ignorant, gullible, weird individuals. However, when we learn that this scam has been carried out successfully in 68 similar fast food settings in 32 different states, in a half dozen different restaurant chains, and with assistant managers of many restaurants around the country being conned, with both male and female victims, our analysis must shift away from simply blaming the victims to recognizing the power of situational forces involved in this scenario. So let us not underestimate the power of authority to generate obedience to an extent and of a kind that is hard to fathom. Donna Summers, assistant manager at McDonald's in Mount Washington, Kentucky, fired for being deceived into participating in this authority phone hoax, expresses one of the main themes in our Lucifer Effect narrative about situational power.
You look back on it and you say, I wouldn't have done it. But unless you're put in that situation at that time, how do you know what you would do? You don't.
In her book, Making Fast Food, From the Frying Pan into the Fryer, the Canadian sociologist Esther Ryder concludes that obedience to authority is the most valued trait in fast food workers. The assembly line process very deliberately tries to take away any thought or discretion from workers. They are appendages to the machine, she said in a recent interview. Retired FBI Special Agent Dan Jablonski, a private detective who investigated some of these hoaxes, said, You and I can sit here and judge these people and say they were blooming idiots, but they aren't trained to use common sense. They are trained to say and think, Can I help you? The Nazi Connection. Could it happen in your town? Recall that one of Milgram's motivations for initiating his research project was to understand how so many good German citizens could become involved in the brutal murder of millions of Jews. Rather than search for dispositional tendencies in the German national character to account for the evil of this genocide, he believed that features of the situation played a critical role, that obedience to authority was a toxic trigger for wanton murder. After completing his research, Milgram extended his scientific conclusions to a very dramatic prediction about the insidious and pervasive power of obedience to transform ordinary American citizens into Nazi death camp personnel. If a system of death camps were set up in the United States of the sort we had seen in Nazi Germany, one would be able to find sufficient personnel for those camps in any medium-sized American town. Let us briefly consider this frightening prediction in light of five very different but fascinating inquiries into this Nazi connection with ordinary people willingly recruited to act against a declared enemy of the state. The first two are classroom demonstrations by creative teachers with high school and grade school children. The third is by a former graduate student of mine who determined that American college students would indeed endorse the final solution if an authority figure provided sufficient justification for doing so. The last two directly studied Nazi, SS, and German policemen. Creating Nazis in an American Classroom. Students in a Palo Alto, California high school world history class were, like many of us, not able to comprehend the inhumanity of the Holocaust. How could such a racist and deadly social political movement have thrived, and how could the average citizen have been ignorant of or indifferent to the suffering it imposed on fellow Jewish citizens? Their inventive teacher, Ron Jones, decided to modify his medium in order to make the message meaningful to these disbelievers. To do so, he switched from the usual didactic teaching method to an experiential learning mode. He began by telling the class that they would simulate some aspects of the German experience in the coming week. Despite this forewarning, the role-playing experiment that took place over the next 5 days was a serious matter for the students and a shock for the teacher, not to mention the principal and the students' parents. Simulation and reality merged as these students created a totalitarian system of beliefs and coercive control that was all too much like that fashioned by Hitler's Nazi regime. First, Jones established new rigid classroom rules that had to be obeyed without question. All answers must be limited to 3 words or less and preceded by "Sir," as the student stood erect beside his or her desk. When no one challenged this and other arbitrary rules, the classroom atmosphere began to change. The more verbally fluent, intelligent students lost their positions of prominence as the less verbal, more physically assertive ones took over. The classroom movement was named the Third Wave. A cupped-hand salute was introduced, along with slogans that had to be shouted in unison on command. Each day there was a new powerful slogan. Strength through discipline, strength through community, strength through action, and strength through pride. There would be one more reserved for later on. Secret handshakes identified insiders, and critics had to be reported for treason. Actions followed the slogans, making banners that were hung about the school, enlisting new members, teaching other students mandatory sitting postures, and so forth. The original core of 20 history students soon swelled to more than 100 eager new third waivers. The students then took over the assignment, making it their own. They issued special membership cards. Some of the brightest students were ordered out of class. The new authoritarian in-group was delighted and abused their former classmates as they were taken away. Jones then confided to his followers that they were part of a nationwide movement to discover students who were willing to fight for political change. They were a select group of young people chosen to help in this cause, he told them. A rally was scheduled for the next day at which a national presidential candidate was supposed to announce on TV the formation of a new Third Wave youth program. More than 200 students filled the auditorium at Coverley High School in eager anticipation of this announcement. Exhilarated Wave members wearing white-shirted uniforms with homemade armbands posted banners around the hall. While muscular students stood guard at the door, friends of the teacher, posing as reporters and photographers, circulated among the mass of true believers. The TV was turned on, and everyone waited and waited for the big announcement of their next collective goose steps forward. They shouted, "Strength through discipline!" Instead, the teacher projected a film of the Nuremberg rally. The history of the Third Reich appeared in ghostly images. Everyone must accept the blame. No one can claim that they didn't in some way take part.
That was the final frame of the film and the end of the simulation. Jones explained the reason to all the assembled students for this simulation, which had gone way beyond his initial intention. He told them that the new slogan for them should be, "Strength through understanding." Jones went on to conclude, "You have been manipulated, shoved by your own desires into the place you now find yourselves." Ron Jones got into trouble with the administration because the parents of the rejected classmates complained about their children being harassed and threatened by the new regime. Nevertheless, he concluded that many of these youngsters had learned a vital lesson by personally experiencing the ease with which their behavior could be so radically transformed by obeying a powerful authority within the context of a fascist-like setting. In his later essay about the experiment, Jones noted that, "In the 4 years I taught at Coverley High School, no one ever admitted to attending the Third Wave rally. It was something we all wanted to forget." After leaving the school a few years later, Jones began working with special education students in San Francisco. A powerful docudrama of this simulated Nazi experience, titled The Wave, captured some of this transformation of good kids into pseudo-Hitler youth. Creating Little Elementary School Beasties, Brown Eyes versus Blue Eyes. The power of authorities is demonstrated not only in the extent to which they can command obedience from followers, but also in the extent to which they can define reality and alter habitual ways of thinking and acting. Case in point, Jane Elliott, a popular third-grade schoolteacher in the small rural town of Riceville, Iowa. Her challenge: how to teach white children from a small farm town with few minorities about the meaning of brotherhood and tolerance. She decided to have them experience personally what it feels like to be an underdog and also the top dog, either the victim or the perpetrator of prejudice. This teacher arbitrarily designated one part of her class as superior to the other part, which was inferior, based only on their eye color. She began by informing her students that people with blue eyes were superior to those with brown eyes, and gave a variety of supporting evidence to illustrate this truth, such as George Washington's having blue eyes and, closer to home, a student's father, who the student had complained had hit him, having brown eyes. "Starting immediately," said Ms. Elliott, "the children with blue eyes would be the special superior ones, and the brown-eyed ones would be the inferior group. The allegedly more intelligent blue eyes were given special privileges, while the inferior brown eyes had to obey rules that enforced their second-class status, including wearing a collar that enabled others to recognize their lowly status from a distance. The previously friendly blue-eyed kids refused to play with the bad brown eyes, and they suggested that school officials should be notified that the brown eyes might steal things. Soon, fistfights erupted during recess, and one boy admitted hitting another in the gut because he called me brown eyes, like being a black person, like a Negro. Within one day, the brown-eyed children began to do more poorly in their schoolwork and became depressed, sullen, and angry. They described themselves as sad, bad, stupid, and mean. The next day was turnabout time. Mrs. Elliott told the class that she had been wrong. It was really the brown-eyed children who were superior, and the blue-eyed ones who were inferior, and she provided specious new evidence to support this chromatic theory of good and evil. The blue eyes now switched from their previously happy, good, sweet, and nice self-labels to derogatory labels similar to those adopted the day before by the brown eyes. Old friendship patterns between children temporarily dissolved and were replaced by hostility until this experiential project was ended and the children were carefully and fully debriefed and returned to their joy-filled classroom.